send it in early, and then go and vote. And if it's not tabulated, you vote, and the vote is going to count.
Fraud in the defense of democracy is no vice. Legality, no virtue. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The murder of two protesters in Kenosha by a gun-toting teen is the latest militia-related story to make headlines, but the movement's origins go way back.
In 1964, 76% of Americans would say that always or most of the time they would trust the government. By 1994, that had dropped to 19%.
And now all it takes to organize outrage into paramilitary action is a place to post and get angry, courtesy of Facebook's algorithm.
Employees are increasingly saying the social effects of this company are frightening and something needs to be done.
It's all coming up after this. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Never has the phrase law and order as invoked by a president come to mean so clearly its opposite, illegality and disorder. Starting with the first, illegality, like voting twice. On Wednesday, Donald Trump encouraged his North Carolina followers to cast two ballots, one by mail and one in person.
Send it in early and then go and vote. And if it's not tabulated, you vote and the vote is going to count. You can't let them take your vote away. These people are playing dirty politics.
In some states, you can ask for your mail-in ballot to be invalidated. But intentionally voting twice is fraud and a felony in most states.
The president defended 17-year-old Kyle Rittenhouse, who traveled with an assault rifle from his Illinois home to Kenosha, Wisconsin, to enforce law and order. And now stands charged with six criminal counts, including first-degree intentional homicide, first-degree reckless homicide, recklessly endangering safety, and possession of a dangerous weapon as a minor. He shot two protesters to death and wounded a third. But to Trump, he is the victim.
He was trying to get away from them, I guess, it looks like, and he fell, and then they very violently attacked him. And it was something that we're looking at right now, and it's under investigation. But I guess he was in very big trouble. He probably would have been killed.
This but one week after his Republican convention showcased accused felons Mark and Patty McCloskey, who'd brandish guns at peaceful protesters in front of their St. Louis home, and who are now official GOP spokesgunmen for the false narrative of white America under siege.
They're not satisfied with spreading the chaos and violence into our communities. They want to abolish the suburbs altogether by ending single-family home zoning. This forced rezoning would bring crime, lawlessness, and low-quality apartments into now-thriving suburban neighborhoods.
Lie after lie after lie from the husband and wife rich lawyer militia, from the Trump campaign, and from the hate factory of Fox News.
When the rioters come for your town, and they're coming, will Biden and his team do enough to stop them? And the answer is clearly no.
These are people who are now crossing state lines, clearly, and this is being organized using the internet.
They will burn down your cities and tell you that you did it. And if you don't accept that judgment, maybe they'll send BLM to your house.
The same race-baiting law and order rhetoric whistled by Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan, now literally weaponized. Let's just put aside lethal pandemic denial and paranoid QAnon fantasies, at least for a second, and consider Trump's warnings of the, quote, dark shadows and deep state moles controlling Joe Biden. You know, those thugs clad in black on airplanes bound to destroy us.
They're people that are on the streets. They're people that are controlling the streets. We had somebody get on a plane from a certain city this weekend. And in the plane, it was almost completely loaded with thugs wearing these dark uniforms, black uniforms with gear and this and that. They're on a plane.
I'll
tell you sometime, but it's under investigation.
They have scary gear. They even have menacing lunch.
And you have people coming over with bags of soup, big bags of soup, and they lay it on the ground, and the anarchists take it, and they start throwing it at our cops, at our police. And if it hits you, that's worse than a brick, because it's got force.
soup assaults on police, he says, every one of whom deserve unwavering support even after the use of deadly force against so many black men and women in this greatest of nations, excluding, of course, the anarchic parts. Defend their actions against fake news, he says, so quick to smear cops for letting their nerves get the best of them.
They choke, just like in a golf tournament. They miss a 3-foot.
You're not comparing it to golf because, of course, that's what the media
I'm saying people choke.
People panic.
I do think that there appears to be a phenomenon in the country where African Americans feel that they're treated, when they're stopped by police frequently, as suspects before they're treated as citizens. I don't think that that necessarily reflects some deep-seated racism in police departments or in most police officers.
Meanwhile, Bill Barr, the nation's chief law enforcer, shrugs at the notion that all-too-frequent lethal force against black people signifies systemic racism. He also mischaracterizes the details of Jacob Blake's arrest on sexual assault charges caught on video that left him with 7 bullets in the back, courtesy of a Kenosha policeman.
In the Jacob case, he was in the midst of committing a felony, and he was armed.
No. Though police later reported finding a knife in the car, Blake was surrounded by police, walking slowly and unarmed when he was shot. Which is where Black Lives Matter comes from, which is why there are protests nationwide, which is why Trump is trying to portray overwhelmingly peaceful dissent as anarchy. Truth is often not black and white. This week, Trump's lies all were, stirring up the very race conflict his most violent supporters most covet. So is this just the latest so-called shiny object? Or is it a line crossed of historic and irreparable peril? Who knows? It's a fool's errand after 4 years of overlapping lies, provocations, illegalities, and inhumanities to declare any one moment a turning point. And yet, with a historic election only 8 weeks away, how not to tremble at the realization of our worst fears of a depraved presidency?
Coming up, when fixing our democracy is inseparable from fixing Facebook.
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The armed right-wingers who have arrived in force at protests in Kenosha, Portland, Harrisburg, PA, Louisville, Kentucky, have been labeled patriot militias, as if that tells you everything you need to know. But the history of America's militia movement, as it's been called, shows that apart from guns, camo, and extreme right-wing ideologies, what passes for a movement is really a grab bag of grievance. John Temple is a journalism professor at West Virginia University and the author of Up in Arms, How the Bundy Family Hijacked Public Lands, Outfoxed the Federal Government, and Ignited America's Patriot Movement. John, welcome to OTM.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I suppose if you asked modern right-wing militiamen when their movement began, they would say it was during the Revolutionary War when civilian Minutemen would mobilize at a moment's notice to fight the British. But you believe that the political and ideological roots of the militia movement could be traced to the mid-1900s.
Yes, there is a lot of symbology from the Revolutionary War that they employ, wearing tri-cornered hats and waving the Gadsden flag, the yellow flag with the serpent coiled on it, and it says, "Don't tread on me." But it really started to coalesce in 1950 with that era's version of the Tea Party, in a sense, the John Birch Society. And then as the civil rights movement occurred and there was more federal intervention in different issues, you had organizations springing up like Posse Comitatus, which believed that the county level government was the supreme authority. We should be making these decisions at the local level.
And I remember rather breathless reports in, you know, Time magazine about militiamen in Michigan, in Hayden Lake, Idaho. It obviously got a lot of publicity.
Yeah, very fringe in those days. But at the same time this was going on, there was this corresponding drop in trust in the federal government. Just to give you an example, in 1964, 76% of Americans would say that always or most of the time they would trust the government to do what's right. By 1994, that had dropped from 76% to 19%. So what was radical gradually became a fairly commonplace concept. You know, that didn't mean that everyone was picking up guns and going to the woods and joining paramilitary outfits, but it definitely became more of a mainstream cause.
They were paramilitary wannabes, but quite disparate until the 90s and one particular event. Can we discuss Ruby Ridge?
Yes. You know, I spent a lot of time with militia people to report the book that you mentioned, Up in Arms. They talk about Randy Weaver like it happened yesterday.
A standoff between a man who is wanted by the FBI and a large number of federal agents.
Surrounding a cabin where a fugitive named Randy Weaver is holed up with his family.
In 1992, U.S. Marshals went to this very rural mountaintop in Idaho to arrest a guy named Randy Weaver. He was a white separatist. He had been arrested on gun charges and he hadn't appeared in court. And a shootout ensued that left both a U.S. Marshal and Weaver's 14-year-old son dead. And an FBI sniper shot and killed Weaver's wife. And it just became this proof that the federal government was overreaching and was going to come for you and kill your family.
So it was the proto-bloodbath, but it wasn't the biggest bloodbath to rally the cause. That would be Waco.
Waco, yeah, a year later.
Under the blistering Texas sun, investigators comb the smoldering remains of the Branch Davidian compound. More than 80 people are believed to have died in yesterday's fiery conclusion to the 51-day siege, 24 of them children.
Branch Davidians was a cult that stood accused of
illegal weapons. So there was a shootout, 4 federal agents died, and 6 sect members died. And then, horribly, the FBI launched a tear gas attack to try to get them out of the compound. A fire breaks out and sweeps through all the buildings, kills 75 people, many of them women and children. Just a disastrous situation. And this became just a big rallying cry for the Patriot Movement.
And since then, thousands of paramilitary groups have sprung up in common cause?
It's not a single movement, really. It's a bunch of different movements. Some of them are fairly organized, and some of them are a couple of guys out in the woods type situation. They had different beliefs. Some were racist. Some were more concerned with gun rights. Some were more concerned with immigration in recent decades. But they realized that racism, overt racism at least, it's not going to take them into the mainstream. And if there's one thing that these folks want, it's to broaden their appeal. They decided to stop using as much racial language and start focusing on 2 issues that were more popular. One being that the federal government was overreaching, and the other that the federal government was looking to take away their guns. And they decided that the most positive name that they could give themselves was Patriots. So that's what they call themselves.
Let's briefly discuss Bundy. That's the subject of your scholarship. This was a Western rancher who was in an ongoing dispute with the Bureau of Land Management about the grazing of his cattle, encroaching on federal lands. Federal government finally, after trying to stop him in court, decided to take more decisive action.
Yes, they sent some cowboys out on this federal land, this land that Clive and Bundy did not own. This is 2014. They knew that the Bundy family might fight back. So they had more than 100 agents of different federal agencies involved to protect them. And Clive and Bundy, who was not a militia member, put out a call to arms saying, they're coming for my cattle. They're arresting my kids, because that was happening as well. And what had happened by this time that was different than Waco and Ruby Ridge was that now we had social media networks. So this call to arms went out and it just went crazy. Thousands traveled from all over the country to fight back.
Demonstrators have rallied to support Bundy, leading to an altercation with law enforcement officials on Wednesday when one of Bundy's sons was tased after kicking a police dog. Jim Lordy came from Montana to join the protesters. He says he and other militia members are not afraid to shoot if necessary.
We need guns to protect ourselves from a tyrannical government.
It turned into a real flashpoint. But the thing that was unique about it was that now they knew how to gather and they knew how to get the word out about events like this.
You made reference to this earlier. It has perplexed me for some years. Is this just a LARP exercise with live ammo, you know, a bunch of men playing paramilitary because it makes them feel powerful or part of something bigger than themselves? Or are these real revolutionaries, by and large?
That's a great question. And it's a question that, of course, I can't answer definitively because, you know, every person has their own individual motivations. But there is an element of fun involved in this. It may not sound fun to you or me, but I think these are oftentimes people who might have mental health problems, or they may have money problems, or they may have been unsuccessful in their personal lives. And this is a way to, you know, get together with other people. But there are others who truly believe in what they're doing, that we're under attack and that the federal government is overreaching.
How could it be that at the moment they have in the Oval Office the very man who at least propounds their nonsense that they're taking to the streets? There's some cognitive dissonance there.
Oh, absolutely. And I spent a lot of time riding around in cars with these folks and going to various events. And it's really, really interesting because, like you said, if the one thing that they did have in common for decades was that they believed the federal government was kind of the enemy. Suddenly, the person at the top of the federal government is espousing, you know, many of the same ideas as they are. What I saw was a split. A majority of people kind of were like, great, we love Donald Trump. But there's this element of purists who are like, you know what, if you are in charge of the federal government, you are the enemy by default. And then there's another thinner slice, and I would include Ammon Bundy, Cliven Bundy's son, who believe that Donald Trump is an authoritarian.
Ammon Bundy posted on Instagram Live about this very thing. Well, here's what it sounded like.
You must have a problem in your mind if you think that somehow the Black Lives Matter is more dangerous than the police. If you think that Antifa is the one going to take your freedom, you must be hypnotized by conservative talk show hosts. Defund the police is the correct thing to do.
Yeah. So, you know, he has gone from being the hero of the movement in, say, 2016 when he was occupying the Malheur Wildlife Reservation in Oregon, to being sort of sidelined.
So it's scattered, it's contradictory, it's often paranoid and fantastic, but it's out on the streets now with loaded rifles. First, how dangerous is this moment? What do you think is its trajectory? And what, if anything, can we do about it?
I will never try to predict the future of what's going to happen next with this movement. You know, these folks are always looking for a cause. They're looking for a Bundy Ranch. They're looking for a Ruby Ridge or a Waco. Word they use all the time is optics. Optics, optics, optics. How does this look on camera? And right now they have a 17-year-old kid, Kyle Rittenhouse, who was, in their view, defending himself. That will appeal, they believe, to a broader slice of the country. And it appeals to Donald Trump. And the other thing is, this is going to drag on for a while. There's going to be court cases. There are going to be opportunities for rallies and events and protests. And the optics from their point of view are good. And then it's taking place in this time where no matter what side you're on, or even if you're in the middle, you know, you're feeling this heightened sensitivity. And we've got someone stoking fear and paranoia. And I mean, every day it gets a little nuttier. What's coming out of Donald Trump's mouth. So it's a scary set of circumstances.
Thank you, John. I'm very grateful.
Thank you for having me.
John Temple is a professor of journalism at West Virginia University and the author of Up in Arms, How the Bundy Family Hijacked Public Lands, Outfoxed the Federal Government, and ignited America's Patriot Movement.
On August 25th, organizers affiliated with a group called the Kenosha Guard shared a call to action on, where else? Facebook. Quote, "Any patriots willing to take up arms and defend our city tonight from the evil thugs?" We know now that the taking up arms in question led to the murder of two protesters at the hand of a 17-year-old vigilante who should never have gone to Kenosha. The scrutiny Facebook has undergone in the aftermath of the Kenosha shooting is well-trod territory for the platform. Just this Thursday, the company released a suite of new regulations aimed at securing the legitimacy of November's presidential election.
In this plan that's rolling out today, Facebook promises to flag or in some cases remove misinformation about voting related to the coronavirus. It will also limit political ads in the week before the election.
A week. The new regulations amount to fixing a nuclear reactor with duct tape and some spit. Facebook, which runs on money-generating algorithms, is hazardous to our collective health, says its former VP for User Growth, Chamath Palihapitiya, because the, quote, short-term, dopamine-driven feedback loops that we have created are destroying how society works. Julia Carey Wong is a senior technology reporter for The Guardian. She says that the violence that spilled into the streets of Kenosha had its origins on Facebook. Of course it did.
The Kenosha Guard was almost exclusively a creation of Facebook itself. The militia leader, quote unquote, is a man named Kevin Matheson. He basically set up a Facebook page during the George Floyd protests, but the page didn't really go anywhere. Up until the police shooting of Jacob Blake, that's when this Facebook event kind of snowballed.
Was the use of Facebook by the Kenosha Guard typical of these vigilante groups?
You know, I'm not entirely sure, but I think it might have been 1 week before this all happened, Facebook announced that they were going to crack down on U.S.-based militias that were using its site to organize. They said that they were taking down 980 groups, 520 pages, starting with the militias that had used language that suggested that they were encouraging violence.
But Facebook did have some basic rules in place for a while, banning organizations from the site that were explicitly violent, like terrorist organizations, criminal cartels. What were the contours of those regulations?
If you have a violent mission, and if you're not state-based, you're not allowed to use its platform. In other countries, Facebook has also banned armed ethnic organizations that might be recognized under international law. Facebook said because they're not state actors, they should not be allowed on the platform. But these rules are clearly problematic. If you look at history, the African National Congress would not have been allowed to use Facebook's tools to connect people that were fighting against an oppressive racist regime. If you look at Rwanda, they would have prevented the Tutsi rebels from using their tools while allowing the Hutu genocidaires, because one was in state power and one was not. There's been, I think, a bit of a double standard. I'm sure that Facebook is full of double standards, but in the US, we have this thriving subculture of militia movements for a long time allowed to remain on Facebook, the Three Percenters, the Oath Keepers, these non-governmental groups that are nevertheless armed and whose rhetoric, at least, if not their actions for the most part, includes a lot of discussion of potential violence. So these are very difficult rules to enforce. They're very difficult calls to make.
Yeah, isn't that the problem, that when the catch-all category at Facebook is, quote, dangerous organization, who gets to determine what that is?
It's of concern. You know, here in the United States, we have a lot of criticism about how Facebook is making these decisions, how Facebook is drawing its lines. 90% of Facebook's users aren't even here in the U.S., where we have the most attention from Facebook's staff. So when we're calling out Facebook for making a mistake in Kenosha, Wisconsin,
you have to recognize that Facebook put more effort into getting that decision right than they possibly could have in any other country around the world, because this is where they have the vast majority of their policy people paying attention to the potential backlash. And even still, they're often making the wrong call.
And recently, Facebook has been trying to figure out how to tamp down on groups that aren't explicitly violent, but could provoke violence. What prompted them to go further?
It was a lot of pressure over how they were going to start dealing with QAnon. QAnon has been exploding on Facebook. It's consistently been tied to vigilante violent acts. And at the same time, you can't look at QAnon and say that it falls into the same category as ISIS or Al-Qaeda. So they were trying to straddle the line between the aspects of QAnon, which are political speech, and the parts that are deeply committed to a false interpretation of reality, to the extent that they might be interested in inciting violence. The fact that QAnon is a pro-Trump movement and that we've seen Facebook show very little appetite for challenging the right in the U.S. probably plays into their decision to chart a middle ground here.
Nor is Facebook banning the groups that it flags as malicious. It's more like, you know, they're on notice.
They've created this separate category for groups like QAnon, militias, and Antifa, to the extent that Antifa uses Facebook, which I think is pretty absurd. They've basically said that all of these groups are on notice. So a normal group, like a neighborhood soccer team or a PTA that uses Facebook, if one person says something violent in that group because they lost their temper, a soccer game goes really bad, or something really outrageous happens at the PTA meeting, the group itself will not be banned. It's possible that Facebook would remove that single post and might put the user that said it in like a 24-hour timeout or something. But for QAnon groups and for militia groups, it's one strike and you're out. You can set up the Kenosha Guard and you can say, this is a militia, we're all about safety. But the moment that you start talking about encouraging violence, that's when you're done.
After the violence, you saw on Facebook and Instagram, which it owns, depictions of the alleged shooter as a saint, as a martyr.
As soon as this shooting happened, Facebook's policy team designated this shooting as a mass shooting. It means nobody is allowed to represent in a positive manner the shooter or the shooting itself. Because we've seen mass killers lionized by extremist groups. And what was really just deeply disturbing was that there was a lot of groups and pages that were posting memes of this alleged shooter, photos of him with his gun. There were taglines saying that he was a hero. One of the ones that just really upset me was a meme that showed a photo of him and it said, three commies down. Ugh. There were also three separate fundraisers for the alleged shooter. Those fundraisers, which are technically banned by Facebook, garnered more than 20,000 shares over a couple of days. Facebook had very little to say for itself. It took them more than 24 hours to get back to my questions and then took down the things that I had specifically linked them to.
Then there's the problem. Facebook's removal of the posts, reinforcing the, you're censoring my right to say things, that whole deal?
Right, exactly.
But how do you thread that needle?
It's a very, very complicated one, right? Because within the first day of this shooting taking place, we saw Tucker Carlson on Fox News offering a justification.
So are you really surprised that looting and arson accelerated to murder? How shocked are we that 17-year-olds with rifles decided they had to maintain order when no one else would?
That kind of set the tone for the way that the right was going to justify this. I don't envy Facebook having to deal with that situation when you have the ruling party offering up a justification for an extrajudicial killing.
In a video that was released from an internal meeting at Facebook, CEO Mark Zuckerberg responded to criticism over the company's impotence in the face of militia organizing.
The contractors and the reviewers who the initial complaints were funneled to basically didn't pick this up. And on second review, doing it more sensitively, the team that was that's responsible for dangerous organizations recognized that this violated the policies, and we took it down.
He blamed it on the contractors, which was interesting. The contractors being people that don't actually work for Facebook, don't actually get any of the perks of working for Facebook, but are kind of tasked with dealing with the worst detritus of the internet every day at low wages, often in other countries.
Yeah, you recently spoke to Ellen Pao, the former CEO of Reddit. She said basically that you subcontract things you don't care about, and you don't care about things you subcontract.
Ellen Pao was the CEO of Reddit, trying really hard to clean up that platform and deal with violence, harassment, and hate on the internet. She said that she wishes that she had brought content moderation in-house. And I was just really struck by that. You know, nobody in Silicon Valley, none of these platforms ever talk about bringing content moderation in-house. It's this huge workforce that is kept off the books. They're often in different cities and different countries. And they're not treated as being as important to the company's mission as the software engineers and the product managers and the ad salespeople.
And being so remote, they can just follow the instructions. They can't make any judgments because a lot of times they just don't know the context.
If Facebook insourced editorial, I think that that would help. It's the largest publisher in the history of the world, and they have entirely outsourced editorial to people that don't work for the company. The content is generated by users, and the content is edited by subcontracted low-wage workers, often in other countries. And then on the other side of it, there's just the sheer size and scale. Facebook is in many ways simply too big to be effectively moderated.
But it does seem that the employees at Facebook are starting to get angry. At the beginning of the summer, there was a digital walkout over Facebook's decision to say that Trump's quote, "when the looting starts, the shooting starts," was okay. This was a company that was used to obedience.
Among all the different Silicon Valley tech companies, Facebook has a reputation of the staff being kind of true believers, that there are no problems that more Facebook won't fix. What we've seen this summer is that Facebook employees are increasingly coming out and saying the social effects of this company are bad and frightening and something needs to be done. And it's not surprising. I mean, most of their employees live in the United States and are now getting firsthand experience of the kind of deleterious impacts that Facebook can have on a democracy that have been seen in the Philippines and Poland and India.
How did you feel when you saw the Kevin Roos piece in the New York Times about how extreme right-wing influencers are dominating the political conversation on Facebook? And we're talking about entirely alternate universes. It's long been the case that we can avoid inconvenient facts, but Facebook seems to have cemented these information pathways to the point where they're like luge slides. You never get off the glide path you were on.
Right. I mean, I thought that that piece by Kevin was really important. I hope that more people, especially more journalists, will take his advice and start spending more time trying to use Facebook the way that people that you don't know use Facebook. There's a tendency in the journalist discourse to say that Twitter isn't real life. But since the pandemic, we've all been living our lives online. The Facebook world that people exist in is real to them. And if you don't really know what this right-wing Facebook ecosystem feels like, you need to kind of take the time and get to know it because it's a different world.
So what would you advise a person who wants to engage with people outside of their luge to do, what would you advise them to bring to those conversations?
The parts of our psychology that Facebook taps into, the structure of its algorithms, is particularly effective for outrage, for anger, for things that are emotive and reactive. But when it comes to the much harder work facing this entire country, trying to build social ties across political disagreements, across social difference, I honestly don't think that Facebook is capable of doing that. Probably you are going to be better off engaging in civic life in your community and trying to help rebuild that outside of the structures that Facebook has created, because those structures at the moment are simply not suited for positive social outcomes.
Julia, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Julia Carey Wong is a technology reporter for The Guardian.
Coming up, a wrong headline and what constitutes news.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Thousands assembled in Civic Center Park, Kenosha, Wisconsin, this past Saturday to decry the police brutality that put Jacob Blake in a hospital bed and locked him there.
I know there's a lot of parents out here in this crowd. You cannot imagine what it feels like to look at your baby paralyzed from the waist down, shackled. Where was my son going? They already put him in the bed.
Blake's father, Jacob Blake Sr., set the tone.
Good people of this city understand, if we tear it up, we have nothing. If you tear it up, then we'll have nowhere to go. I don't want you all to be homeless. I don't want you to be storeless. I don't want you not to be able to buy your sons, daughters, and grandbabies the food and the milk that they need. Yes. Do me a favor. My nation is asking. Yes. Stop it. Yes. Stop it.
Other speakers included Wisconsin Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes, U.S. Congressperson Gwen Moore, and a speaker whose name we still don't know, who strayed way off message.
One of ours, it's time for us to kill one of yours.
Those words of rage and despair played into the very race war fears being stoked by Trump, the GOP, and the right-wing media sphere. So what does the Daily Kenosha News put in its headline? That outlier expression of anguish, the inflammatory threat. Daniel Thompson was a digital editor at the Kenosha News until Saturday, when he resigned over his objections to the headline. Daniel, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you for having me.
So you texted the boss, executive editor Bob Heiss, and said what?
I screenshot the headline, I circled it in red, and I sent him a text saying, I want to know exactly who wrote this headline. I sent a few more texts, the last one I think stating that I don't know if I can associate with the company after this and I need to calm down, but I wanted you to know immediately. And you can tell by my wording that I didn't believe that Bob was the one who wrote the headline.
And Heiss replied. Now, did he say, gee, Daniel, it seems newsworthy to me, but as the Kenosha News's only black editor, perhaps you are sensitive to something that I just don't see. Let me mull this over and think about the context and the likely effect of this decision. Is that what he said?
That is not what he said. His reply was that I should, yes, calm down. He said that it was a direct quote from the event and that it was a public threat, and therefore kind of saying that it was a valid thing to put in the headline. That led to me saying that I quit.
Now, I should observe that the decision to highlight one moment out of a long day of speeches is not in and of itself bad journalism.
No.
We are
no.
trained to focus on the most newsworthy detail, even if it's only an instant. But If the instant that you choose to journalistically isolate mischaracterizes the news event and inflates an outlier moment, and especially in this environment stokes fears, you believe what?
I believe that you're being irresponsible. And it's been in my experience, even covering protests, that the way that people have thought about approaching stories in the past does not do justice to stories revolving around issues such as justice for Jacob Blake, George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, police accountability, and things like that. Because in these situations that are very tense, very volatile, it's almost more important to set up the context completely in which they're taking place before you start throwing out these big quotes.
In the past, when you flagged issues of insensitivity or nuance, Heiss and other editors listened and, as I understand it, often accommodated your concerns.
Yes, that's almost what makes it more surprising, is because we did have a relationship where I was very vocal about things that I didn't agree with. We could talk about these things, and in the end, maybe they saw my point, maybe they didn't, but more often than not, if my point was valid, things were adjusted.
We invited Bob Heiss to speak to us. He declined, but he did give us a quote, which is, "Our staff has been working tirelessly to cover the protests and civil unrest in Kenosha. The community depends on us, and we are working under challenging circumstances. We are telling all sides of the story with photos, videos, and stories, and we will continue to do so." Now, you want an apology from the paper to the Blake family at a minimum. That isn't one, is it?
No, but I do understand. Here's the thing. The Kenosha office is taking a lot of heat right now for something that was not the fault of anybody in that office. Besides, you know, my interaction with Bob. I've said I would not name the person publicly, but I'm comfortable saying that person did not work in that Kenosha office. In ways, it makes me even more angry that Lee Enterprises and publisher Mark Lewis, who oversees WizCon Valley Media Group, which is Kenosha News, Journal Times, and Lake Geneva Regional News, he hasn't said anything either, and I'm sure he knows exactly who did it too. But he's letting Bob and the Kenosha staff take all the heat.
This summer, the New York Times media columnist Ben Smith wrote about the generation of Black journalists who covered Ferguson in 2014. He connected their experiences then to changes that we're seeing in American newsrooms now as they, quote, try to find common ground between a tradition that aims to persuade the widest possible audience that its reporting is neutral and journalists who believe that fairness on issues from race to Donald Trump require clear moral calls. Was the decision to stand by this headline immoral?
Perhaps. I still wonder in the back of my head how we got here. But I've thought there are a few options. For one, there is the possibility that it is a boss who has been, yes, working tirelessly and working many hours and doing so because he's short-staffed because of cuts by the parent company over the years, who is lacking sleep and probably angry, and then he has an employee basically address him in a tone of complete insubordination. Was it a pride thing? Was it anger? Was it a culmination of just what he was dealing with? Probably. Was it a moral stand? Maybe. And then there's the third option of Bob wasn't the one who did it, but he wasn't also going to throw the person that did do it under the bus. So as much as people want to give me credit, I think Bob should also get credit too. Because even though this wasn't his fault, he hasn't put the blame on anybody else.
Well, you're clearly fair-minded and beyond that which I expected, to tell you the truth, under these circumstances. Which makes me wonder, going back to that Ben Smith column, whether you agreed at the time or embraced the notion that the rules of journalism, which cleaved so heavily on being disinterested observers, do have to change under the circumstances of social and economic injustice. Are you radicalized by this experience?
It radicalized me at first. If you see my tweet and everything, my sudden, angry, almost dictator-like call for this person to publicly apologize or I'm going to name them. Yes, I had a radical moment. I was angry. And I'm thankful that people actually responded to that tweet and questioned me on it. And as the day went on, as my anger dissipated, I started to see their point. It would be almost the most hilarious example of hypocrisy to rail against my former employer one day for their irresponsible acts that put the Black community, or even the local community in general, in danger, when I'm threatening to do the same thing, but not to a community, to a specific person and a specific family. And in that moment, I realized that I had become the equal opposite reaction of what they did. So yes, there were moments where I kind of lost control, but now I'm back in control. Back to more objective perspective of things. And I'm happy to be.
One last thing, Daniel. When this happened during this momentous episode in the struggle for social justice and against racism and police brutality, you were the only Black full-time member of that newsroom. The story isn't over. In fact, we're seeing other coverage that is beginning to peel back even more of the layers of social injustice in Kenosha in particular. But now there are zero full-time Black employees of the Kenosha News. Do you think in the end this episode will help the proper telling of a complex and heartbreaking story? Or have you walked out with the only sort of institutional knowledge required to keep that coverage honest?
No, not at all. The Kenosha News staff is incredible. Deneen Smith, Jill Roselle, Heather Pointer, Liz Snyder, Dan Trutchell, Terry Flores, if I hadn't mentioned her already, James Lawson, Sean Krajacek. These reporters and photographer have worked so hard to cover the community. As much as people like to think that I've been speaking up in the newsroom, they're the ones who have spoken up to me when I'm wrong. So do I think that the lack of diversity is troubling? Yes. But I also know 100% that there are good, unbiased reporters in that newsroom because I've worked with them side by side for years. I don't worry about Kenosha with that reporting staff there. I worry about what management does to what that reporting staff turns in.
In the aftermath of all of this, you have announced that you're going to stay in town. You're going to publish an online independent news site, and you had a GoFundMe or some other online tool for generating some capital, and the community responded.
In droves. And honestly, I don't even know how to react to how nice everybody's been. Because for a lot of my life, and especially the past few years, suffering through my own kind of verbal abuse as a journalist covering certain things, I was feeling very cynical and, in fact, made many social media posts about losing my faith in humanity. And in all of this, it's been completely restored. It's funny. The Kenosha News and leaving that ends a chapter of my life. But everything that's happened afterwards puts me in a much better position for the next chapter, both as a person and as a professional.
Dude, you are so Wisconsin nice. I do not know how to process this. Your equanimity is just, it's hard for me to get my head around.
I worked at a small town in Nebraska, and I didn't know in small towns anywhere that everybody just waves at you when they drive by. It took me days to adjust to that level of nice because I was like, wait, do I know that person?
Well, I feel like you're waving to me. Daniel, thank you so much.
Yeah, well, thank you too.
Daniel Thompson is now an independent digital journalist in Kenosha, Wisconsin. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Michael Loewinger, Leah Fetter, John Hanrahan, Zandra Ellen, and Eloise Blondio. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Josh Hahn.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.